he faces internally?
It's a real risk, Juan, and I think there's a few factors there, right? So, of course, Hezbollah, which is the Iran-backed militia in Lebanon, Hezbollah has indisputably hit Israelis, right? There is a lot of fear among Israelis, tens of thousands of whom have left northern Israel for fear of an October 7th style attack by Hezbollah. So Netanyahu can tap into that fear. And the added layer of this is that there's Netanyahu's political survival, and then there's the question of who comes after Netanyahu if he does fall. And at a moment where upwards of 70% of the Israeli public are in a sort of pro-war mood, right, are still feeling under attack, into retaliation, there's also a benefit for other politicians to seem hawkish. So that means Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who's kind of led the threats against Lebanon. It could also mean some of the candidates who the U.S. really has talked about as alternatives to Netanyahu, like Benny Gantz. There isn't really an anti-hawkish narrative inside the Israeli body politic right now. There's an anti-Netanyahu one. So the actual risk of war, I think, is only growing.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Akbar Shahid Ahmed, senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. We'll link to your articles at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO, Portland.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without you, our listeners. And if you missed out on any of our programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
Hi, this is Cecil Prescott. Celeste Carey and I are the co-hosts for More Talk Radio, which airs on KBOO FM 90.7 on Mondays at 8 a.m. For 30 years, Celeste and I have been encouraging and engaging interviews and conversations about politics, social issues, and things which concerns you, your family, and your community. Join us on Mondays at 8 a.m. and be a part of this community radio experience.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, say goodbye to Measure 110. The rules change for U.S. train operations. And in international news, Israel makes it harder for groups to deliver food in Gaza. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. Drug possession in Oregon is about to once again be a crime. Governor Tina Kotek just signed House Bill 4002, which expands funding for substance abuse treatment, but also makes possession of small amounts of hard drugs a misdemeanor. The legislation passed the Oregon legislature by wide margins. It rolls back a key provision of ballot measure 110, which had decriminalized possession of small amounts of cocaine, fentanyl, and methamphetamine. Oregon voters approved measure 110 in 2020. Kotek said, quote, "Success of this policy framework hinges on the ability of implementing partners to commit to deep coordination at all levels, courts, Oregon State Police, local law enforcement, defense attorneys, district attorneys, and local behavioral health providers are all critical to these conversations and necessary partners to achieve the vision for this legislation," end quote. She added, "This is a different approach to where we were before Measure 110 took effect. Legislators hope the legislation will get more people connected to therapy. The new law allows drug users to deflect from the justice system into treatment programs, but the law allows for a county-by-county approach. That was a required compromise made to get law enforcement groups on board. To date, only 23 of Oregon's 36 counties have agreed to some kind of deflection program. The state still estimates hundreds of additional people will be jailed for misdemeanor drug possession. Some are concerned Black Oregonians will be overrepresented in the legal system under the new law. Criminalizing the possession of small amounts of drugs will also take more public defense resources. Oregon is already falling behind in terms of its obligations under the U.S. and Oregon constitutions to provide defense attorneys to anyone charged with crimes who cannot afford a lawyer. Currently, more than 2,500 people charged with crimes do not have a public defender. Measure 110 did not mandate training for law enforcement. The new legislation still does not make it a requirement, but Kotek's signing letter mentions a May 9th training symposium. The governor recently said, quote, "My expectation is that there will be appropriate guidelines and training for law enforcement to understand what is now different, what that means for deflection." That did not happen under Measure 110, and I think that's why you didn't see the violation pathway working as well as it could, end quote. The ACLU opposes the new law, believing it may actually defund treatment. Lane County District Attorney Patty Perlow said she's not sure an unclassified misdemeanor charge is going to be severe enough to prompt people to enter treatment. New misdemeanor charges for drug possession go into effect on September 1st. Major freight railroads have to maintain two-person crews on most routes under a new federal rule that was finalized today. The Transportation Department's Federal Railroad Administration has been working on the plan for the past 2 years. There has been intense focus on railroad safety since a major derailment in eastern Oregon in 2023, but few significant changes have been made. A railroad safety bill proposed in response to the derailment previously stalled in Congress. Rail unions have long opposed one-person crews for a variety of reasons related to safety and job concerns. Labor agreements requiring two-person crews have been in place for 3 decades at many major railroads. Eddie Hall, the president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen Union, said, quote, "As trains, many carrying hazardous materials, have grown longer, crews should not be getting smaller," end quote. He praised the FRA for taking the step President Biden had promised. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said, quote, "Common sense tells us large freight trains, some of which can be over 3 miles long, should have at least 2 crew members on board. And now there's a federal regulation in place to ensure trains are safely staffed," end quote. The railroads themselves wanted the discretion to operate trains with only one person and to remove conductors to ground-based jobs in places where automatic braking systems have been installed. That has been a key issue in contract talks in the industry for years. They argue the size of train crews should be determined by contract talks, not regulators or lawmakers, saying we do not have enough data to show that two-person crews are safer. The FRA abandoned a similar rule during the Trump administration, with the agency previously saying there wasn't enough evidence to support it. The East Palestine, Ohio derailment put the spotlight on rail safety because of the disastrous consequences of the hazardous chemicals that spilled and caught fire in a major crash. Thousands of people were forced to evacuate their homes, and they have lingering health concerns. Investigators have not suggested the crew on that train did anything wrong. It actually included 3 people because there was a trainee on board. Instead, the National Transportation Safety Board has said the derailment was likely caused by an overheating wheel bearing on one side of the rail cars that wasn't caught in time by trackside sensors. The worst railroad disaster in recent history did involve a one-man crew. In 2013, the brakes failed on a train parked in Canada. The train rolled downhill and derailed, killing 47 people and causing millions of dollars in damage. At least 11 states have already approved rules requiring two-person crews. Some, frustrated with the federal government's reluctance to pass new regulations on railroads, have also tried to pass restrictions on train length. The railroad industry often challenges state rulings in court, but railroads generally argue in those states' lawsuits that the federal government should be the only one to regulate the industry. Maryland officials want to help with the Baltimore Harbor. A New Jersey ballot design is ruled unconstitutional. And there's good news for California's food workers. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This is not a Baltimore catastrophe, not a Maryland catastrophe. This is a national economic catastrophe as well.
Maryland Governor Wes Moore says a prolonged closure of the Baltimore Harbor will have ripple effects across the U.S., and funding to rebuild the key bridge should be a bipartisan priority. President Biden says the federal government will pay for the entire cost, but some lawmakers say the owners of the ship that hit the bridge should first be held accountable. The Florida Supreme Court says a six-week abortion ban there is constitutional, since the state's right to privacy doesn't apply to the medical procedure. However, justices also ruled that a ballot initiative to protect the right to an abortion can go before voters in November. A federal judge has struck down a controversial New Jersey primary ballot design. Democratic Congressman Andy Kim is running for Senate and says the design favored party-backed candidates by confusingly putting those without party endorsement on a separate part of the ballot.
I just think that's unfair. You know, you should not be able to put the thumb on the scale of our democracy for people who are well-connected, well-off.
500,000 fast food workers in California just got a pay raise. A new law means workers at chains with more than 60 national locations will now earn $20 an hour. Labor organizer and jack-in-the-box worker Anisha Williams says when workers organize, they win.
This is for my ancestors. This is for all the farm workers, all the cotton pickers. We ride on their shoulders.
Some chains, including McDonald's and Chipotle, have said they'll have to raise prices. A Texas appeals court has overturned the conviction of a black woman sentenced to 5 years in prison for once voting illegally. Crystal Mason says she didn't know she couldn't vote while on supervised release from prison when a poll worker offered her a provisional ballot.
I lost jobs, lost insurance. Every night, crying, praying, asking God, when is the end? You know, I knew victory would be the outcome. I can tell you that.
Her attorney says Texas Republicans sought to intimidate other voters, especially people of color, by making an example of Mason. Republican Congressman Tim Walberg of Michigan says his recent comments regarding the war in Gaza were not meant to be taken literally. During a town hall last week, Walberg seemed to say Israel should use nuclear weapons.
We shouldn't be spending a dime on humanitarian aid. I agree. It should be like Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Get it over quick.
Walberg says his comments were taken out of context and that the quicker the war ends, the fewer innocent lives will be lost. Meanwhile, the Israeli prime minister says he'll close the independent Qatari news network Al Jazeera in the country. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Completing the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, is required by many colleges if a student wants to get aid. But this year's form has been delayed and it seems to be flawed. Joe Ullery tells us more from Indiana.
Indiana's high school seniors are caught in a bureaucratic snarl as glitches in the free application for federal student aid rollout hinder aid processing. This year, seniors must complete FAFSA or opt out by April 15th to graduate, coinciding with Indiana's state aid priority deadline. Delays in the form's availability until January exacerbated confusion, leaving many families unsure of their financial aid eligibility. Bill Wozniak with InvestEd is reassuring students and families and emphasizing the collective effort to navigate the chaos.
Families are getting nervous about their FAFSA, nervous about college deadlines, nervous about deadlines for financial aid. And so all these different things are having people and the colleges on edge as they try to get things set for the upcoming year.
Wozniak says despite setbacks, resources such as InvestEd aim to support Hoosiers in accessing Indiana's education fund, ensuring that no student is left behind in the pursuit of higher education. This year's problems are not any one family's fault and have no doubt been frustrating for everyone involved.
Other families across the country and here in Indiana and the colleges are aware of what's going on. If families and students are able to get a hold of us, no matter where they are in the glitches or where they are in the process, we will be able to get them across the finish line.
Colleges and universities rely on on the FAFSA to determine financial aid packages for students. Many schools are juggling the setbacks and delays when assessing what aid is available, forcing some universities to push out application deadlines. I'm Joe Ullery, Indiana News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned later for the award-winning show, Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 8 o'clock, it's Reggae Bobcast. Tonight, rain is likely with a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will show considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers. The high will be 52. Today in history, in 1513, Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon landed on the shores of what is now Florida. And in 1902, Electric Theater, the first full-time movie theater in the United States, opened in Los Angeles. The quote of the day is from radio host and Reed graduate Dr. Demento, born this day in 1941. The good doctor said, at least on a Simpsons episode, "It's time for more dementia." An Israeli airstrike killed 7 aid workers from World Central Kitchen, leading the charity to suspend food delivery to Gaza. Ships laden with some 240 tons of aid from that organization had just arrived and now is turning back from Gaza. Experts say famine is imminent. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu directly acknowledged that the country's force had carried out the unintended strike on innocent people. He said officials were looking into the attack and would work to ensure it did not happen again. World Central Kitchen said it coordinated with the Israeli military over the movement of the cars carrying the workers as they left northern Gaza yesterday. The airstrike punched a large hole through the roof of one aid truck. Two other vehicles in the convoy were incinerated, perhaps indicating multiple hits. Footage showed many bodies at a central Gaza hospital, several wearing protective gear with the charity's logo. Those killed include 3 British nationals, an Australian, a Polish national, an American-Canadian dual citizen, and a Palestinian. The killings will almost certainly have repercussions on multiple levels. The dead included citizens of some of Israel's closest allies. Israel has already come under international criticism because of its nearly 6-month-old offensive in Gaza. The strike might also impede efforts by the U.S. and other countries to open a maritime aid corridor from Cyprus. Israel has already barred the main United Nations agency in Gaza from making food deliveries in the north, and sending truck convoys to that area has been extremely difficult because of the military's failure to either grant permission or ensure safe passage. Israel maintains its efforts are aimed at destroying Hamas after the October 7th terrorist attacks on Israel. Israeli forces have demonstrated readiness to inflict widespread damage on areas where they believe a suspected militant is present. The military has allegedly struck ambulances and aid vehicles, saying that armed fighters were inside of them. More than 32,900 Palestinians have been killed in the war, but Israel blames Hamas for civilian deaths, saying it operates in populated areas. The U.S., Britain, Poland, and Australia called for an investigation or an explanation from Israel over the aid workers' deaths. Israel is forming a professional team to investigate the strike and plans the opening of a joint situation room, enabling coordination between the military and aid groups. The World Central Kitchen charity operates in several countries racked by wars or natural disasters. The organization says it is heartbroken by the deaths of the staffers. At least one other aid group that has been operating in the Palestinian territories is pausing its own operations in Gaza. Some 200 humanitarian workers have been killed in the war. Hamas is still believed to be holding some 100 Israeli hostages and the remains of 30 others. It's hard for one Navajo community to access services off of the reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Without a direct route, it takes 3 hours for one community on the Navajo Reservation to get medical care and other services in a town that's only 45 miles away. But if a new road was built, it would take about 30 minutes. KUER's Tilda Wilson reports for the Mountain West News Bureau on efforts to find Utah state funding.
The first step for building the connecting road is a $4 million environmental impact study. The Navajo Nation has committed to paying for half of that. Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley says the remaining share was initially included in this year's state budget, but it was pulled at the last minute.
This morning, we were told that we look underneath every cushion, underneath every couch, and we can't find $2 million.
This is the third year in a row that this has happened. State funding early on is critical to obtaining federal money for the $140 million project. Democratic Senator Nate Bluin supports the road.
It's $2 million of a $28 billion budget. It's a fraction of a percent, and to shove it off as a, you know, low budget year, especially when this has been brought forward for a number of years, is, I think, a bit disingenuous.
The Navajo Nation has pushed for the road for the past 15 years. Curley says they'll continue to be persistent until they get the road constructed.
That was Tilda Wilson reporting. The Nebraska Winnebago Tribe's Ho-Chunk Community Development Corporation, or HCCDC, has been awarded $2 million through Mackenzie Scott's Yield Giving Company. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
Some 6,300 nonprofits applied to Yield Giving's open call for grants, and HCCDC was among 279 to receive a top-tier rating. 82 organizations in the next highest tier each received $1 million. HCCDC Executive Director Christine Earth says the tribe has a lot to be proud of, but a lot of work left to do.
We're so excited and we're so thankful for this generous gift for our community. We do have a lot of issues. We have a lot of health disparities, and so a donation like this really is going to make an impact for our entire tribe as a whole.
HCCDC marks its 20th anniversary this year, working to improve economic, educational, and social opportunities for tribal members. Earth says it also has five key initiatives: housing development, commercial development, financial services, quality of life, and food sovereignty. The Winnebago tribe has experienced huge growth in its middle class in the past few decades, but roughly 30% of its members still live in poverty. Earth says through its farmers market, HCCDC is tackling both health disparities and food sovereignty.
Through our farmers market, now we're able to touch on not only agriculture and tribal farming, but also our healthcare system, offering the fresh fruits and vegetables and the Indian corn, things that will restore the health of our people.
Earth says Winnebago is in a food desert, making food security a major focus for the tribe.
It's hard for people to access fresh fruits and vegetables, and we have such a growing community. We are all coming together to grow our own food and to feed ourselves so we can be sustainable in the future.
On the website, Mackenzie Scott calls all the open call grant winners vital agents of change. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
Traditional games kick off Friday in Juneau, Alaska. Athletes from 29 teams across Alaska, Canada, and the lower 48 are expected to compete. More than 260 middle school, high school, college, and adult athletes from more than 20 communities will take part in 12 events based on hunting and survival skills of Indigenous people. The games are different from other sports as athletes competing against one another also encourage each other to reach new personal bests. Coaches give helpful tips and guidance to athletes from opposing teams. The event is open to parents and adults, and non-native athletes are also welcome to compete. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New York wants to repeal a 100-plus-year-old law against adultery. Edwin J. Vieira tells us more.
Of New York's many outdated laws, the adultery law could go this year. A bill repealing the 1907 New York adultery law passed the Assembly and is now in the Senate. Adultery is a misdemeanor crime carrying a penalty of up to 90 days in jail. The repeal's current sponsor is Long Island Assemblymember Charles Levine, although its original sponsor was former Assemblymember Dan Court. The repeal bill has wide support, but Levine notes there has been pushback and hate mail about its passage, too. He says the adultery law has always been controversial.
When it was enacted in 1907, there were many letters to the editors of the then responsible press complaining about the legislature taking it upon itself to regulate human nature and morality.
The 1965 State Law Commission sought to repeal the law but never did. This was because some politicians argued repeal then would seem as if the state were endorsing infidelity. This time, the bill to repeal the adultery law passed out of the Assembly Codes Committee unanimously and was approved by the chamber. The bill now goes to the Senate. History is full of laws on morality, not just in New York State, but nationwide. The 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution led to the country's 13 years of prohibition. But Levine says similar morality laws, like states' bans on in vitro fertilization, have no place in government.
This is just repugnant. It's repugnant to the American spirit of fairness. Laws are enacted to express the desire to protect community, and they're also enacted to serve as a deterrent.
Adultery is a felony in 3 states, while 14 others, including New York, consider it a misdemeanor. In 2019, a flurry of states worked to pass bills repealing their adultery laws. Utah was successful, while others, such as Massachusetts and Virginia, saw the bills fail in committee. Levine says probably many outdated laws still exist on New York's books, but he feels getting rid of this law ends any embarrassment for the few people the state charged with adultery. Although he considers it a trite saying, it's apt in this case, that those who cannot learn from history are doomed to repeat it.
We have to stand up today for our rights. We have to protect our citizens. We have to protect the people of the United States. And we have to lead the way, not only in New York, but in the United States as well.
This is Edwin J. Vieira.
An independent Palestinian survey research organization has published an opinion poll from Gaza and West Bank residents. We now go to commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Khalil Shikaki, director of the highly respected independent research organization, the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research in Ramallah, has just reported the results of a poll of Palestinians. Shikaki's data collectors asked more than 800 people in the West Bank and 750 people in Gaza, all face-to-face, these questions. Do they support the Hamas attack on October 7? Who do they think will win the war? And what do they want to happen afterward? Here are some of the principal findings of the poll. First, almost 80% of Gazans report that at least one of their family members has been killed or injured. 3 months ago, only 64% reported the same. Almost two-thirds blame Israel for their suffering, and most of the others blame the U.S. In the Gaza Strip, only 9%, a 10-point drop from the previous poll, blame Hamas. Second, while support for Hamas's offensive on October 7 remains high, Palestinian support in the West Bank has in fact dropped by 11 points, while support in the Gaza Strip has increased by 14 points. The polling organization says, quote, "It is clear from the findings, however, that support for the offensive, that is the attack of October 7, does not mean support for Hamas. Instead, the findings show that three-quarters of the Palestinians believe that the offensive has put the Palestinian-Israeli issue at the center of attention after years of neglect at the regional and international levels." Unquote. Third, almost all Palestinians think Israel is committing war crimes, while almost all believe Hamas is not committing war crimes in the current war. Moreover, more than 90% believe that Hamas did not commit any atrocities against Israeli civilians during its October 7 attack. Only 1 in 5 Palestinians has seen videos showing atrocities committed by Hamas. The findings show that those who have seen the videos are almost 10 times more likely to think that Hamas men have committed atrocities on October 7. Fourth, regarding leadership of the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas, the longtime leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, has very limited support. More than 60% of the public want a government that is neither under the control of a political party nor under the control of Abbas. Two-thirds continue to express the belief that the Palestine Authority is now a burden on the Palestinian people, and the majority favors its dissolution. And last, two findings that are especially noteworthy. Support for the two-state solution has increased significantly, and support for armed struggle has dropped significantly. However, the increased support for the two-state solution, while dramatic, came only from the Gaza Strip, a 27-point increase, while remaining stable in the West Bank. Given three choices for ending the Israeli occupation, the current findings indicate a 17-point decrease in support for armed struggle, a 5-point increase in support for negotiations, and a 5-point rise in support for nonviolence. What overall conclusions can we draw from this poll? First, it is clear that Palestinian opinion on virtually all questions is quite different in the West Bank and Gaza. That is especially so when it comes to support of Hamas, which, as we might expect, is far stronger in Gaza than in the West Bank. Second, it is striking how few Palestinians are aware of, much less condemn, the October 7 Hamas attack. Third, the poll confirms the extremely limited support for the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank. The PLO's unpopularity is one reason the U.S. plan for post-war Israel calls for removal of the Abbas administration. Fourth, and most encouraging, is the substantially increased support for the two-state solution. That finding suggests a key role for the U.S., the European Union, and others in identifying and backing Palestinian civil society groups that can provide new leadership in a future Palestinian state. I will have additional details on this poll in my Thursday Global Citizen International Digest broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Mel Gertov.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Joe Ullery, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, and Antonia Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area, and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Making
contact.
Making contact.